Alice Roosevelt Longworth enjoyed her fame for all of her 96 years. My research into her voluminous papers has proven that Alice Longworth was also a woman of astonishing intellectual breadth and a forceful personality that shaped history and determined the destinies of nations.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'd like to announce a special program that we've added that is not in the month's program, but we've added because of interest in the topic. Next Monday, March 24th, at 11 a.m., Peter Rodriguez, who is a professor at the Darden Business School, will come to talk about the economic crisis that is affecting Wall Street today. I just checked the Dow, and it's actually up a tiny bit this morning. But it will fluctuate, as we know. Today, our guest is Stacy Cordery, who teaches history at Monmouth College in Monmouth, Illinois. Dr. Cordery's interests bridge many of those of the Miller Center. She actually works with her students on doing oral histories. They're doing oral histories of Vietnam War veterans and other 20th century history topics. So it's a particular pleasure to welcome her to the Miller Center. She got her bachelor's degree in theater from the University of Texas, which I think is a wonderful preparation for somebody who wants to write history books, particularly those that are accessible to the general public. Her graduate degrees, her master's, and her PhD are also from the University of Texas. As I mentioned, she now teaches history and is chair of the history department at Monmouth College in Illinois. She has done a lot of work on the history of the Roosevelt family, and her book that she's going to be discussing today is a biography of Alice Roosevelt Longworth, From White House Princess to Washington Power Broker. Please welcome Stacy Cordery.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Or as we Roosevelt scholars would say, happy wedding anniversary of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, because that's what today is. Well, I'd like to begin by thanking George Gilliam and the Miller Center for Public Affairs for inviting me to speak with you today. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm particularly happy to be here because in Virginia, it's springtime, and in Illinois, we saw our first robin this past week, so I have hope, but I will bring the news home that spring is on its way. Well, the Miller Center's annual report for the most recent two fiscal years begins with the Miller Center Director Gerald L. Belisle's letter, which itself opens with a sentence I'd like to use today to direct my presentation on Alice Roosevelt Longworth. Mr. Belisle wrote, "The power of ideas and the force of personalities shape history and determine the destinies of nations. This notion," he continued, "guides the Miller Center's focus on issues important to the governance of the United States." Well, it is distinctly difficult to pare down the marvelous and amazing 96 years of Alice Roosevelt Longworth's life to a 30-minute presentation. Goodness knows that her meteoric rise to celebrity status, her intriguing relationships with her family and with men like Senator William Borah, and her many famous quips are fascinating. But in keeping with the Miller Center's mission, I want to focus today on the force of her personality and how it shaped history. Because no one occupied the place in this nation that Alice Longworth did. And while she became famous because of her father, it was the force of her personality that kept her before the public eye and thus gave her the occasion to shape history. She was never elected to an office, never appointed to a position, never held a job that came with any title or power. And yet Alice Longworth broadened the arena of behavior for women, influenced powerful individuals, and helped shape at least three public policy initiatives that I can document. But first, a very brief background to get us all caught up to the time that Alice Roosevelt entered the public stage and to understand through her childhood the genesis of this unique personality. Alice Lee Roosevelt was the daughter of Alice Hathaway Lee of Boston and Theodore Roosevelt. She was born on February 12, 1884, and 2 days later, both her mother and her paternal grandmother died on Valentine's Day, 1884. Theodore Roosevelt, nearly overcome with grief, handed his infant daughter over to his sister Anna, who raised Alice for the first few years of her life. Eventually, T.I. recovered from his grief enough to fall in love with his childhood sweetheart, Edith Kermit Corot, and they married when Alice was three. Edith's sense of duty drove her to reclaim her husband's child, and so Alice joined T.R. and Edith's household. But Edith was already pregnant with her first child. Meanwhile, Theodore was busy establishing himself in Republican Party politics, and as a result, Alice always felt like the outsider in the nursery. She never seemed to have enjoyed that ideal of unstinting love and undivided attention from her parents. The Roosevelt home soon filled with Alice's four half-brothers and one half-sister, and they all moved between Washington and New York according to the dictates of T.R.'s various jobs: author, U.S. Civil Service Commissioner, President of the New York City Police Commissioners, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Rough Rider, Governor of New York, and Vice President of the United States. Alice's upbringing was unusual in that she had no formal schooling. She was a true autodidact, and much of what she studied was the politics that swirled around her. She met all manner of important people, and this would be true throughout her life. For example, Alice knew every president from Benjamin Harrison to Gerald Ford. She called politics a daily dish of the Republican household, and political discussions did happen over the dinner table where you can be sure all of the children were present and included. Well, in September 1901, when McKinley was assassinated, T.R. assumed the presidency, and the Roosevelts joyfully moved into the White House. At that time, Alice was a shy, introverted, self-centered 17-year-old, bent on her own devices, as she would be the first to tell you. This changed rather quickly after her debutante ball in early 1902, and then her first real step into the national spotlight, which followed soon after that. This is when she christened the American-made yacht of the German Kaiser Wilhelm. Alice was, as you may know, a controversial and charismatic first daughter who thought nothing of flouting social conventions. She was beautiful, charming. She drew crowds of 100 and later crowds of thousands of people. She had babies named after her, a color named after her. People sought her autograph, then they wanted her photograph, then they wanted her autographed photograph. She widened the sphere of acceptable behavior for women as they copied her dress, her mannerisms, and her actions. Every rule Alice broke as first daughter just made her more popular with most Americans. Not all. One woman called her a young wild thing in good clothes. And she didn't mean it very nicely. But Alice developed a very strong-willed personality and an independent spirit. She came of age in the fierce glare of these international flashbulbs, and she learned very quickly that she was not going to be able to please everyone. So she decided she would live her life pleasing herself. This independence of mind and action would characterize Alice her entire life, and this is the personality that will help shape history. This brings me to the first example of Alice's public service. In 1905, her father sent her on a goodwill mission to Asia. She accompanied Secretary of War William Howard Taft and a boatload of congressmen and their wives. The purpose of this junket was to spread American goodwill during the time of the negotiations during the Russo-Japanese War. T.R. wanted to maintain a balance of power in Asia, and Taft wanted Congress to learn firsthand about American interest in that part of the world. The first daughter was the chief goodwill ambassador. She was the first daughter ever to be used in such a way by a president. She met the leaders of Japan, China, Korea, and the Philippines, and she did all those things that one does in that position: presided over public ceremonies, cut ribbons, viewed orphanages, schools, hospitals, attended innumerable formal dinners, shook countless hands, wore native costumes, and engaged in conversations with officials and with the public. She was a great success, as ultimately was her father's mission. T.R. settled the Russo-Japanese War, and for it was the first American to win the Nobel Prize. Alice, at the time of this trip, was 21. I just want to stress again that at the time of this very successful, very public trip, Alice was the wild child daughter, and it was of her that President Roosevelt said famously, "I can be president of the United States, or I can attend to Alice. I cannot possibly do both." Now, Alice understood politics, even as a teenager. While she was in the United States, she would smoke, gamble, drive unchaperoned, carry a snake to parties, bet on the horses, and so forth. But while representing America abroad, her behavior was impeccable. This matters because Alice's personality, her father could trust her to represent him and the country, and thus smooth the way for critical diplomacy, the end of which affected the future of Japan, Korea, Russia, and the Philippines. Well, after her famous White House wedding to Ohio Congressman Nicholas Longworth in 1906, Alice, now a young bride, set out to learn about politics systematically. Foreign policy always interested her more than domestic issues. The result was, as World War I loomed, she had very strong opinions about President Wilson's proposed project of the League of Nations. This was the precursor to the World War II era United Nations, as you know. For a number of reasons, chiefly that giving the power to make war to the League would usurp the power of the United States Congress, Alice fought alongside a number of congressmen and interested others to defeat the United States' entry into the League of Nations. Despite an initial groundswell of support for the League, the Battalion of Death, as her group was called, did effectively convince the Senate and President Wilson, and after him, President Harding, not to join the League of Nations. For her tireless work, lobbying, editing speeches given by congressmen to drum up support, keeping an eagle's eye on the trajectory of the arguments as she watched every day's debate in Congress, and stiffening the spines of those legislators who wobbled, Alice earned the nickname Colonel of the Battalion of Death. It is very significant, this title given to her by her colleagues. It's a nod to her father, Colonel Roosevelt, but more critically, it is an acknowledgement of her leadership. Alice Longworth was the recognized leader of a successful and long-running political campaign which had a tremendously important result. The U.S. did not join the League of Nations. For better or for worse, she led a successful campaign to defeat U.S. entry. Now, certainly the next 20 years would have played out very differently had the United States been a member of the League. Alice was an isolationist in those days. I think we forget today the true horrors of World War I. We forget the trench warfare, the mustard gas, the first time humans killed anonymously without seeing the whites of their eyes and without recognizing your enemy's essential humanity. And we forget the utter futility of the war and the absurdity of the causes of World War I. But Alice and most Americans of the time remembered this as they looked towards World War II. Recall that World War II began in Asia in 1937 and in Europe in 1939, and as late as 1940, the fall of 1940, on the eve of Pearl Harbor, polls showed that most Americans wanted nothing to do with that war. Alice joined an organization called America First, whose only goal was to keep the United States out of World War II. Alice Longworth was on the board of the National Board of Directors and on her local Washington, D.C. chapter as well. America First trumpeted the fame of many of their members to suggest to Americans that they should join this illustrious group. People like Herbert Hoover, Robert Taft, John L. Lewis, Lillian Gish, Charles Beard, Robert Frost, John Dewey, Chester Bowles, Hugh Johnson, E.E. Cummings, John F. Kennedy chaired the Harvard chapter. America First functioned as the King's loyal opposition, keeping up a steady barrage of anti-war propaganda, not pacifist, but isolationist, and making sure that President Roosevelt knew that he faced an organized opposition. They believed that immersion in the European war would undermine American democracy and capitalism and decried every step Roosevelt took that violated the Neutrality Acts. They were very effective at mobilizing isolationist sentiment. Alice's name was critical because she was a Roosevelt too, and thus offered Americans a kind of a choice between Franklin Roosevelt, the president certainly, but if his own family members could criticize him, could have doubts about America moving towards war, then it meant that other Americans could share these doubts as well and then join America First, as they hoped. They were so effective that Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of War credited America First with, quote, having fought the president almost to a standstill near the end of 1941 when the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor took the decision out of American hands, close quote. Of course, immediately after Pearl Harbor, America First disbanded, and Alice and the others threw their support behind the Allied effort. Alice Longworth's principled stance on all political topics drove her to write a syndicated newspaper column in the 1930s. And I'm backing up to an earlier phase of FDR's presidency here. Alice was a Republican. Franklin was a Democrat. She felt strongly that FDR's social programs and his foreign policy during the Great Depression years were all wrong. And she did not hesitate to say so in this very popular syndicated newspaper column. It was brave to write because she was one of the first and loudest voices of criticism of FDR. She felt she could attack his policies in print because they were related by birth. It was tribal. That was Alice's phrase. It was tribal. So everything from his Latin American initiatives to his alphabet soup agencies came under the scrutiny of her pen, including his desire to run for an unheard-of third term. Alice Longworth had many supporters. She got lots of fan mail for this column, but of course she also had many detractors. We often forget, I think, that Franklin and Eleanor were not universally loved in the 30s and 40s. At the time, there were Americans who thought them, well, more sinners than saints. And Alice's home became a magnet for all those people in Washington who loathed the FDRs. In fact, the most hateful things Alice ever said were about Franklin and Eleanor. Franklin, she claimed, was one-third mush and two-thirds Eleanor. She thought it was a pity that no one could get the pants off of Eleanor and onto Franklin. Now, that's a double whammy there. She called Eleanor a Trojan mare. Another double hit, because part of that was a reference to Eleanor's appearance. As FDR's violation of the Neutrality Acts became apparent, Alice suggested that he was acting just like a dictator, and she said FDR apparently stands for Führer Duce Roosevelt. I know. The very complicated relationship between Alice and FDR and ER is fascinating, and she did keep her harshest denigration of her cousins out of her columns. But her inside criticism of the New Deal is another occasion where Alice's personality came into play, and in this case, influenced the timbre of public discourse about Franklin Roosevelt and his administration. Now I want to turn to a different sort of service, not quite so public, but one that was definitely beneficial to the country. That is, for 50 years, Alice Roosevelt Longworth hosted Washington's most important salon. Her home was a gathering place for public servants, including journalists. They came to dinner, or to tea, or to poker games. They came from both sides of the aisle and from all spectrums of debate on any given topic. I will say parenthetically that those broad-minded, both sides of the aisle invitations did sort of take a hiatus during the New Deal years. Alice liked especially to seat people of precisely opposite viewpoints right next to each other, because she said she liked the fireworks. But as usual with her, there's something beyond the quip. In fact, what happened in her home is that politicians came to this neutral ground where they had to be civil. They shared a toast, discovered points of convergence and compromise, made connections, broadened their networks, they got along. Even when so-called political enemies came together, they were usually there with their wives, which meant the politicians were forced to see that their enemy was human. You know, he had a wife who loved him. He ate with a fork and a spoon. He could be gracious in company and so forth. Common ground, common ideas, common humanity, common beliefs in the future of the country. All these were reinforced at the Longworth home. Now, why is this important? Christy Miller, who is herself a Washingtonian, an author and a journalist from a political family who knew Mrs. Longworth very well, feels that there are no longer any such salons in Washington. And this is one huge reason, Christy Miller thinks, that politics today are so acrimonious. I cannot overstate the importance of what happened at the Longworth home at 2009 Massachusetts Avenue. Alice Longworth didn't just have politicians. She also invited scientists. She was particularly fascinated with evolutionary biology and astronomy. She had novelists, nonfiction authors, public intellectuals, Supreme Court justices, diplomats, ambassadors, and visiting dignitaries. These are people who frequently came to Washington and said, I'm not interested in meeting the president quite yet. I'd really like to meet Washington's other monument, as Joseph Alsop styled Alice Longworth. The journalists who frequented her salon all kept a code of silence about what happened there. It was a different era. Even presidents came to Alice Longworth's house. She was that famous. Her political savvy was so widely recognized that her name was considered for the vice presidency in 1928. Around that time, New Yorker magazine called her the most influential woman in Washington. She made the cover of Time magazine. One famous reporter wrote, "An invitation to the Longworths is more prized by the discriminating than an invitation to the White House. Heavy politics are played at the Longworth House, and Alice sits in. She knows men, measures, and motives, has an understanding grasp of their changes. It is too bad for the Roosevelt dynasty that Alice wasn't born a boy. She is the smartest Roosevelt there is." One of the reasons people wanted to be invited to Alice's home is because she could do really important things for or against your career. This is a result of the force of her personality, which was recognized by everyone. For example, Alice Longworth was credited with saying in 1944 that GOP candidate Thomas Dewey looked like the little man on the wedding cake. Now, this is the year that FDR was running for a fourth term, and people still credit Alice today with that remark. You know, afterwards, no one could take plastic playboy Tom Dewey very seriously. Of course, it would have irked Alice to no extent to know that she had anything to do with her cousin's fourth election. In fact, Alice, who was known all over the world for her witty sayings, did not say that about Dewey. There were two reporters for the Democratic Digest who hoped to torpedo Dewey's campaign. They came up with this phrase, but they couldn't figure out how to get it bruited about town. So what they did is they came up with this idea to tell everyone in Washington that Alice had said it. So they went to parties and they said, "Did you hear what Alice Longworth said about Tom Dewey?" Spread like wildfire. While Alice Longworth helped inadvertently to doom Dewey's candidacy, she also helped to build careers, most notably Richard Nixon's. Nixon and Alice Longworth had a real friendship, that was her phrase for it. She liked Nixon's hard stance against communism. And Nixon himself gave Alice credit for his considering the vice presidency. He was ready to say no when he had what he called one of those behind-the-scenes conversations with Alice. "For the good of the party," she told Nixon, "you should take the vice presidency." And she was very pleased when he did. In fact, Alice did more than just that for Nixon. Nixon was a stiff, gruff outsider from California and a junior congressman when Alice took him up. She included him in her salon. She quite carefully introduced him to movers and shakers higher up the political hierarchy than he was likely to meet otherwise. Access to her salon gave him instant credibility with Washington insiders. He met people there, and he was taken seriously, even during those days of ill treatment by President Eisenhower. And I will say, Alice did lose patience with Nixon at the end of Watergate. She said about Watergate that her shoulders were in a constant state of shrug. And she feared near the end that Nixon's potential clock, as she put it, was dicking away. She was considerably advanced in age by that time, however, and so she enjoyed the spectacle. By this time, Alice Longworth said she looked upon the world with malevolent detachment. So in her salon, a half century in duration, it functioned as a private space for the discussion of public concerns. Alice Longworth was not the only salon, but it certainly was the most famous, and it was a political salon dedicated to political topics. And yet, what happened there is very difficult to say specifically. People often ask me, what exactly is it that Alice Longworth did? And I can point to what I've told you. She served as a goodwill ambassador, she led the successful defeat of the League of Nations, she wrote a syndicated newspaper column, she worked on behalf of U.S. isolationism in America First, and throughout all these years and beyond, she had this salon. She also threw her support behind various politicians. It did not guarantee their success. She backed Mr. Republican Robert Taft. It didn't get him anywhere. She was a big supporter of Senator Borah. He never got to the presidency. She also campaigned on occasion too, lending her name and her fame to the cause. She certainly had very, very close ties to some important figures, like Theodore Roosevelt, whose speeches in 1912 she used to edit and give suggestions about. To Senator Borah, to her brother, Ted Roosevelt, to John L. Lewis, to Ruth Hanna McCormick, and many more. She was what we might call today an unpaid political consultant for these people. They sought her advice on political matters. She also did have some more formal duties in the Republican Party, but these were occasional. She was a convention delegate once. She helped to fundraise, for example. Occasionally, too, she would lend her name to causes, but very few. You don't see Alice's name smattered all over letterheads, for example. So the true extent of what Alice Roosevelt Longworth did to influence public policy, I think, will never be fully known. Because she was a woman of a certain social class and era, it's impossible to discover the full extent of her influence. But precisely because of the era and her class, she could hold sway over Washington. Many, many people commented on her intelligence, on her wide range of expertise. Alice Longworth read 5 newspapers every day. She inhaled books, like all Roosevelts do. She taught herself Greek at age 80. She remained fascinated her whole life by everything from Romney culture to genetics to poetry. Her friend, Admiral Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy as he's known, sent her a book once on nuclear physics, which she devoured, and then sent back to him with a correction to one of the mathematical calculations. Alice Roosevelt was born in an era when a woman's name was supposed to appear in the paper only 3 times, at her birth, at her marriage, and her death. A man would have been churlish to broadcast the conversations that he had had with a woman. And of course, there was that societal bias against women's intelligence. If you got a brilliant idea from a woman who was your wife, well, you could claim that as your own in public because she was your wife. Now, if she was not your wife, it was either a suspect idea, because it came from a woman, or it wouldn't be chivalrous to tell this and to attribute her, or maybe both. And this is mostly why, with few exceptions, women's historians have a very difficult time pinning down women's influence in politics and past the most public, and then, for that part, the most radical actions of the most public and radical of women, like Susan B. Anthony and Alice Paul. By the time women got the vote, Alice Longworth was in her 30s. She was married and respectable. She could have run for public office, but she was too shy. So in addition to more concrete examples from Alice Longworth's public life, there is that long-term sort of subterranean woman's power, the power of networking, of bringing together, of quiet influence that I know animated Alice Longworth and resulted in public change. Do I have a zillion letters wherein male politicians confess to their friends they had just come from Alice's home where her arguments had moved them to change their mind about a bill? No, I don't. Nor would I expect to find that, given the social norms of the day. Well, I actually do have some, but they mostly come from Senator Borah, and given the intimate relationship between Senator Borah and Alice, I kind of have to put those to the side. But this non-public power of Alice's is no less real, I think, for being impossible to pin down. The source materials we historians need to prove our interpretations are lacking in these cases. I think and I feel, however, that Alice certainly did play a crucial role in formulating public policy by bringing insiders to her salon and by talking with them. Alice was not the sort of woman who would retreat to one room with the ladies and leave the men to themselves. She went right with the men. But I cannot footnote my hunch. And this is the tragedy of women's historians, right? We can't footnote our gut. I can speculate, however, that the conversations around her dinner table, enlarged by the force of her personality, decisively contributed to the shaping of public policy for the nation's capital and beyond. That salon of hers was the powerful nexus of the social and the political worlds of Washington, D.C., the city of conversation, as Henry Adams styled it. Well, Alice Roosevelt Longworth enjoyed her fame for all of her 96 years. She died in 1980 with 2 people next to her, very beloved, including her granddaughter. While many people today remember Alice for her witticisms, as cutting, as honest, and as screamingly funny as most of them were, my research into her voluminous papers has proven that Alice Longworth was also a woman of astonishing intellectual breadth, profound patriotism, broad political concerns, and to conclude with George Belial's words, powerful ideas and a forceful personality that shaped history and determined the destinies of nations. Thank you.
Let me open with a two-part question. There have been many other children of presidents who would have served during, would have been in the White House during her lifetime. Did she have a relationship with any of the other presidential children who grew up in the White House? And what is your notion as to why other presidential children didn't achieve the influence that, that she achieved during her lifetime?
Oh, that's a good question. If Alice Longworth had relationships with the other presidential children, I don't know of it. I don't know that she did. She did know many of them. In fact, there were some gatherings where, of course, where these presidential children would have, you know, been together. She quite liked the Johnson daughters, was fond of them, and she was fond of the Nixon daughters as well. But when she was younger, I don't know of much interaction with other presidential families. Now, as to why Alice Longworth achieved this sort of fame and influence, while maybe perhaps other presidential daughters, other presidential sons did not, I think we have to start with the very trenchant fact that Alice really did enjoy the spotlight. She liked the fame. She enjoyed being the center of attention. And I'm not sure that's the case with all other presidential children, some of whom were forced into the spotlight because their fathers got them into this mess, you know, and then they were quite happy to get out again. So she liked that. And, you know, it was more than just cultivating a sort of a famous persona. You know, she used this persona throughout her life, and I think this was, again, something other women, particularly presidential daughters, didn't do. But I would also, as a historian, remind you of the time. Other presidential daughters, think about in our lifetimes, have gone on to careers. You know, they've become lawyers and consultants and so forth. And Alice never did that. So I think partly it was the time and partly it was her own enjoyment of the spotlight.
Would you consider Arianna Huffington or Pamela Harriman to have salons, or didn't you think they quite made the grade?
Well, if you notice, I very carefully quoted my friend Christy Miller, who does live in Washington, so I do not live in Washington, and am still awaiting that invitation from those two women you mentioned. So I can't tell you what happens on the inside of their homes. My sense is that the difference between what Alice Longworth did and other salon hostesses, for lack of a better word, was to bring such a broad array of people together for such a long, long time. I mean, Alice really was an institution in Washington, D.C., and people really did say, I don't want to meet the president, I want to meet Alice Longworth. And so I think it was the combination of simple duration and the fame. You know, she was Theodore Roosevelt's daughter. Roosevelt was an incredibly charismatic and well-loved president in his day, even though, you know, his reputation sort of comes and goes. And so I don't know particularly, other than to tell you that my friends who live in Washington tell me it's not the same thing.
Listening to your description and thinking about Alice Blue Gown and the famous song that came out about her as well, also reminded me of Princess Di, who, of course, died young as far as comparison with Alice. What other women do you find to whom she was comparable?
Oh, well, I probably should have a long list, but, you know, I'm her biographer, so I tend to think she's incomparable. I really think that no one is really like Alice. She came to fame, as I started, because of her father, and didn't want to be first daughter. She was quite happy off playing with her friends and doing whatever it is teenagers do, you know. But she became kind of addicted to the spotlight as she was a teenager, and I think that this spotlight, my book talks more about this, I think the spotlight took the place of that attention she never quite got from her parents. And so she enjoyed this, and I think she enjoyed tweaking TR just a little bit, you know, because she knew which buttons to push. And so as she gained in stature and importance and then worldwide fame and then gained in importance in Washington, D.C. because of the politicians she knew and with whom she interacted, I think it was all I think it created a package that was very unlike other women. I mean, she was famous her whole life. I still, when I talk to people, even people who were not alive when Alice was alive, even they know her. It wasn't very long ago that I think it was the Washington Post, maybe even the New York Times, that had a color section on wedding gowns in 2005, and they named one of the wedding gowns the Alice Roosevelt Longworth wedding gown. 2005, it was 100 years after she was in the White House. So I don't know anybody who's quite the same. And I guess 100 years from now, if we're still talking about Princess Di, then she might be it.
We visited Sagamore Hill, and we had a wonderful docent that took us through. And Alice said, "Father would like to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral." My question was, how old was she when she married Nicholas Longworth?
Well, she married in 1906, and she was born in 1884, so she'd have been, what, 22? Yes. So she was 22 years old, and he was about a decade and a half older than she was. And, you know, there are insinuations that at her wedding, Alice, who had no bridesmaids at all, decided that she would be the only focus of the flashbulbs that day. However, I will hasten to tell you that as a historian, I did some research and I realized that it was quite common for brides of that era not to have any bridesmaids. So it may have been a TR influence. Alice learned everything she ever knew about publicity from Theodore Roosevelt. She was a very apt student. TR was very good manipulating the press. He knew precisely when to release certain stories. He had his own little club of journalists who he felt had betrayed him in some way and kept them out of the best news. Alice was very chummy with journalists and with cartoonists like John McCutcheon. She knew all these people. She was fond of them. One of those letters I have from Senator Borah to Alice said, "I wonder how your protege, Frank Kent, is getting along." And of course, Frank Kent was a famous reporter, I think, from Baltimore, right? And so she cultivated these men and knew them quite well, and she was one of them herself, of course, when she started to write her column. But she liked the inside story that the journalists had, so she could always get the newest trends from them as well. That's a good quote.
Could you comment a little bit more critically on Alice's isolationism, and in particular, analyze for us what she knew about fascism and the Nazis, and what her views were about that, and if we were going to be isolationist, who did she think was going to take care of them?
Right, well, that is a big criticism of Alice Longworth, and of course, everyone in America First as well. But nobody in America, except very, inside the State Department, as far as I can tell, knew a whole lot about what was going on in terms of the genocide of the Jews, for example. More generally, right. Well, she certainly understood fascism. She was a pupil of politics, so she could define it and understand it. And there's not a whole lot in her papers where she ruminates, at least on paper, about these topics. She did, however, feel that Europe's business was Europe's business, and the United States should stay out of it. And I don't think anybody really saw the threat from the fascists in Europe until we were into the war, in quite the way maybe Franklin Roosevelt did. I mean, there were people who sounded warnings. In part, the America First was created to be oppositional to White's committee to defend the Allies, right? And so there were people who knew, and I think she knew, but at the end of the day, Alice was a conservative Republican isolationist in those years. And the people who should take care of fascism was Europe. And once, Pearl Harbor happened, she got on board. She did war work, just like all the rest of the Roosevelts did, so she was behind the cause then. But I think she really, I'm an historian, and I'm not a psychological historian. I did not write a psychobiography of Alice. In fact, I think I must have gotten it right, because one critic of my book said, "The problem with this book is there's not enough psychology in this book." And another critic said, "The problem with this book is that there's too much psychology in this book." So I don't know. But as a historian, I'm happier with the documents. And if I were to veer away from the documents for a bit, I would say that the time in Alice's life where she was in some ways, the most energized but also the most unhappy was when Franklin Roosevelt was in office. She really, truly had substantial disagreements with his policies and with his foreign policy in particular. And she, what's behind this, of course, is that she didn't think Franklin Roosevelt was the Roosevelt who should have been in the White House, right? It should have been Ted, should have been her brother. She worked very hard to try to see that Ted followed the trajectory of her father to get there. And if it couldn't be Ted, well, maybe Nick, her husband, would be okay. And if it couldn't be Ted, well, maybe Senator Borah, you know, could be. But none of them ever got there. And I think she was, on a personal level, very, very saddened and disappointed by this. And it gave an edge to her. I mean, honestly, what I quoted you about Franklin and Eleanor, these are some of the ugliest things that Alice ever wrote or said. And I think it had to do with her own personal disappointment in that era. One of the things I tried to do in this book was to recover Alice from that, from just the witticisms. People know Mrs. Longworth for those quips and those witticisms. And those, I think, come from, many of them come from after the Franklin Roosevelt years. And we forget all the work she did beforehand. And that's partly what I tried to do and what I want to talk about today was some of that earlier stuff. So I won't tell you that I support every, I mean, that I'm a fan of every decision Alice Longworth made. And that is the big criticism of America First. But to the best I can understand it, it was part and parcel of her dislike for Franklin Roosevelt's policies, undergirded by her personal dislike of the fact that it was Franklin Roosevelt in the office and not someone else, you know.
After the war, did she and Eleanor ever achieve any kind of Rooseveltian accord?
Well, you know, that relationship with Eleanor fascinates me. When the two were young women, they saw each other a little bit, but not a lot, because Edith Roosevelt, Alice's mother, did not want Alice connected to Eleanor because of the alcoholism that ran through Eleanor's family, in this sense that somehow it was communicable, that Alice would be tainted by the alcoholism in Eleanor's family. So Edith kept the two girls apart. But there's that famous story of when they were teenagers. Alice and Eleanor were together, and Eleanor was lecturing Alice on the appropriate behavior with young men and the gifts that one could accept from young men. And she said, you know, I've gone blank on what they were. But she listed several things that was appropriate to receive from young men, but never, never, never jewelry, Eleanor said. And Alice said, meanwhile, I sat all the while listening to her fingering a modest string of seed pearls I've been given by a male admirer. So they were like oil and water in terms of their temperaments when they were young women. But as they got older, Eleanor and Alice were there for each other at important moments. Particularly, I would say Eleanor was there for Alice at difficult moments. When Alice's daughter died, Eleanor was right beside her. When Nick, Alice's husband, died, Eleanor was right there beside her. And Eleanor extended several invitations to Alice's daughter to play in the White House, and so I think that there was, I would never really call it a rapprochement, but I would say that the two women were aware of one another, and while they were not temporarily alike, there were points of connection. There were letters between them. They kept up with one another, but again, Alice said of Eleanor that Alice said she left the good deeds to Eleanor. Alice left the good deeds to Eleanor. Eleanor, that was Eleanor's bent, but after Eleanor died, Alice had a lot of very nice things to say about her and recognized that she did good work as a first lady and so forth, and the United Nations too. It was a complicated relationship.
I'm wondering if you could shed some light on whether she participated in or had any influence in the women's right to vote, or was there an aura at all that women were as equal as men in those times?
That's a good question. Alice was very involved in the 1912 campaign, the Bull Moose campaign of her father, where you probably know he supported women's suffrage. And Alice, at that time, it's all throughout her diaries, she did support women's suffrage and was very excited that her father would support it. And when Nick finally voted for women's suffrage, she made a sort of huzzah in her diary that Nick had finally come on the right side. Now, did she ever work in any formal way for women's suffrage? No, she did not. And there were very few women of her class who did. And the ones who did, you know about them because there are that few, and it was that unusual for elite women to be working along those lines. I think Alice believed that she had more power in her drawing room than she had with a single vote. Although she did vote, she voted every election in her life. She went to the conventions of both parties for many, many years. And so she took her this obligation seriously, but it was not something she worked for in a formal way. That would have been one of those good deeds she left to Eleanor.
Following up on the question on her involvement with the suffrage movement, one of the other major movements of the sort of late progressive era was the eugenics movement. And you mentioned her interest in evolutionary science. Did she ever get caught up in the eugenics movement?
No, I think she was interested in it. And I sort of speculate in the book a little bit about why that might be. I think it was less eugenics than it was evolutionary biology as a whole. It was a cutting-edge science, you know, and as you said, very much in the news. But, you know, this is a woman who had never known her mother. So in this way, I think there's some, I mean, she knew her Lee relatives, and one thing that Edith did as her stepmother was to make sure that she connected with those Lee relatives in Boston. So Alice went back a couple times a year, every year, to get to know those folks. But I think it was Alice Longworth's interest in evolutionary biology came about partly from her father's interest in social Darwinism, and I think it was tangled up with the fact that she was this sort of orphan in a way, you know, and that when her mother died and never knew her. So I think there was a personal aspect of it to her, but I never have seen any suggestion anywhere that Alice flirted with eugenics or thought that was a good idea. That's just not in her papers.
I'm a longtime fan of Theodore Roosevelt. And I'm wondering, since her genetic makeup is clearly 95% his,
yes,
whether you know anything at all about her mother's genetic makeup and how Alice's remarkable personality and demeanor might have been affected in any way by it.
By Alice Hathaway Lee?
Mm.
That is an interesting question. She was built like her mother, I can tell you that. She physically resembled her mother in height and in sort of that willowy gracefulness that Alice had her whole life. Because she knew her Lee relatives and knew them well, and the Lees were, her grandfather, George Lee, was a Boston banker, and they had apparently lots and lots of money, and Alice as a young child used to comment on how she hated to come back to Sagamore Hill because in Boston, when she went off to Boston, she got crustless bread and she got all these wonderful foods and so forth that she and she had them all to herself, of course, because she was the spoiled, lovely child of their deceased daughter. So she had a wonderful world there. So I think that perhaps some of Alice's desire for a wealthy husband might have come from the Lees. I think she had a taste of a kind of good life over there, which she was petted and made much of. And she was just one of the group, you know, at Sagamore Hill. Well, that might be it, because all throughout Alice's diary, she writes often, I want to marry a rich man, you know. And she always said, I never have enough money. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough money, you know. And she was consistently going back to her grandfather, George Lee, who was good for her, loved her dearly, to say, Grandpa, I just need a few more dollars to tide me over. I'm just a little bit over my budget, please. And George Lee would write back and say, well, I'll send the money, but we won't tell your grandmother, will we?
One more question, a little less political. As important as she was, and as much as she was in the press, how did her relationship with Bill Borah and the child not get mentioned too much?
It was a different era. It was just a different era. There were rumors about Senator Borah and Alice Longworth that swirled around Washington, D.C., and there were jokes about them. You know, the old joke about what does a brand new parquet floor and the Longworth baby have in common? Not a trace of a nick in either one. I know, that's terrible, isn't it? So there were rumors. There was the rumor that Alice wanted to name the child Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H, Deborah of Borah. Yeah, no, I don't know. But the rumors were there, but it was never, it seemed to have been hushed up. And I guess what I can tell you is that either all of Washington was rife with people having affairs like this, where no one talked about it because everyone knew your secrets, so they weren't going to tell mine, you know, or all those journalists she cultivated and had to her poker table kept her secret. It could be. Now, I have read the diary of Ruth Hannah McCormick, who was Alice's best friend. And Ruth was very plain in this diary that she had kept Alice's pregnancy a secret. And the day that it was released to the papers, Ruth sort of speculated on what this would mean for Nick. So Ruth clearly knew that Nick was not the father of Alice's child. I'm not sure who else knew. And that's a very interesting topic in a kind of a prurient way. It's interesting. So I can't exactly tell you why that was kept out, but it was never verified. And one of the, I think, interesting things about my book is that when I was researching this, I was granted access to thousands and thousands and thousands of documents, letters, social calendars, drafts of speeches, anything you can imagine from Alice's granddaughter, who was very, very generous to me. And among these documents from the granddaughter were all these hundreds of love letters from Senator Borah to Alice. And in the love letters, I can, for the first time, verify that Senator Borah was, in fact, the father of their child. And it's really interesting because he used codes. There are three codes that Senator Borah used to when he wrote letters to Alice. And they're very sweet codes, but one of them gives away his paternity.
Two questions. One, just a follow-up on that. In your main presentation, you implied that there was still Borah papers you didn't have access to. Is that so? And will that come out? And secondly, did she have a relationship with Katharine Graham? Social relationship, I mean.
Right. I don't know of any Borah papers that exist that I have not consulted. The Borah letters in the Library of Congress are, as all of Borah's biographers have said, a kind of a wasteland for any emotional hints, any sense of Borah's personality. They're all letters to constituents, so they don't go very far, which is why the love letters were so important. In these love letters, Borah confesses his depression, his feelings about his constituents in Idaho. He kind of bled for those farmers out there. I mean, so he really becomes much more well-rounded and nuanced as a human being in those letters. But if there are more, I don't know about them. I'd love to, if you've got an attic full or you know someone with an attic full, I'll take them. Katharine Graham, Katharine Graham and Alice Longworth knew one another. I think she respected Mrs. Graham, certainly read her newspaper. And if you read Katharine Graham's two books, you will see Alice Longworth referenced there. But I don't think it was a really close relationship. Alice was much older, Katharine Graham was much younger. But they did know one another.
Every historian finishes their work and knows that there are unanswered questions that they would like to explore, like their successors to explore. What were the unanswered questions at the end of your work on Alice?
Oh, dear. I guess I have questions that I would ask her if she magically walked through that door. I guess I would like to know about the extent of her shyness. This always seemed to me to be a kind of a contradiction in terms to me. But everyone with whom I spoke, everyone I interviewed, said, yes, Alice Longworth was really shy. And this really was one reason she did not run for political office. So I would like to know the extent of that. I guess I would like to know what happened at those dinner parties. I can't magically recreate them. So I would like to have been a mouse in someone's pocket to see what topics were covered, what they talked about. Did those men walk away saying, aha, now I understand this issue better. Now I'm going to change my vote tomorrow, or now I'm going to reword that bill. I don't know. I suspect that happened, but I wasn't there. So I guess I'll answer your question in a sideways way and say, what I would have liked to have done is to have been at one of those poker parties. She was supposed to be really good at poker. I'd like to have been at one of those poker parties or at one of those dinners or one of her teas, which she had every day. Alice had tea every day of her life, and almost always there was someone there with her or someone's there with her. So I would have liked to have seen what went on in the inside. I would have liked to have sat by that pillow that said, if you haven't got anything good to say about anyone, come and sit by me.
The career of Alice Roosevelt Longworth, both public and private, spanned some of the most important and contentious episodes certainly in the 20th century. And this important book sheds light on those episodes. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.